Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name is Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by business marketers for business marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketers. Today, we have over 1,000 participants across the world. If this is the first time you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, welcome back. It's good to have you along again. In this episode, I'll be speaking to strategy consultant Uri Baruchin about the leader's lament in business branding. Plus, Lisa Daniels, the head of marketing at BT Enterprise, on the future of DM. Rachel Evans shares a key lesson that she's taken on the journey to being co-founder of Stack for Business. And Rebecca Highfield, marketing manager at Action Rocket, celebrates some great business marketing. Ready, set, then let's go. Business branding itself has a bad brand. It's said to lack independent inspiration. There's no need for emotion because the focus is on getting to the RFP or tender. And instead, it's a tick box exercise that encourages businesses not to differentiate. So they say, but is that fair? I'm joined by strategy consultant Uri Baruchin. Uri, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell us a bit about your work.
So I work as a creative strategist and strategic thinking coach and mentor with an emphasis on brand consulting, advertising and marketing communications with both B2B brands and B2C brands.
And you've written about the leader's lament. So tell us a bit about what the leader's lament is.
Right. So the leader's lament is part of my ever-growing collection of marketing tropes or plots, if you will. Basically, it is the lament my clients have that what gets a B2B brand to the top seems to stop working at the top. And here's how it plays out, right? So many of the brands I've worked with through the years were top 10 or top 5 in their sectors. Now, getting to that level in most B2B cases can take decades for an organization. So it's especially true with professional services, by the way. But when you look at the leadership sets from accounting to engineering, the leaders are often quite same-ish. And a lot of the branding can be a bit bland despite lots of investment and a spectacular amount of clever people and good partners working on it. So my clients often come to us because they are struggling to stand out from the other leaders and get any attention to the marketing. And that kind of like got me thinking, what is happening here? And what I believe happens is that in B2B, in order to get to the top in most sectors, you get there by learning over years to tick the boxes clients most care about and, you know, put on RFPs or similar mechanisms. Mm. There's little drive to discover new insights or interesting angles when your audience makes you a list. And it's quite a long list, often with similar priority across items across the list. So you have this tremendously successful corporate brand that got ahead essentially by learning to tick the boxes better than almost anyone else. And now they are at the top with all the others top box tickers, and they're all the same. So you're in the room, but you're like anyone else in the room. So you feel you've arrived, but the other people in the room and the people watching the room take it for granted. And it feels like no one cares about your journey. And it's a very simple pattern, but it can be very hard to break out from because your entire organization at this point has just been through a decades-long training program at ticking boxes. And if you try to create any marketing that is distinctive, you'll have all your stakeholders telling you, hey, where are all the boxes? Where's the laundry list? And that will happen until anything even mildly interesting just gets watered down. they'll say, this is how things work in this industry, and that's that. And even if you are not a leader yet, often it means better box ticking is what each iteration is about. And that's it. That's the one thing almost every B2B client I've ever worked with can relate to, this immense black hole-like generic gravitational pull.
So the obvious assumption that underpins all of this is that there is value in brands being distinctive or differentiating in B2B. So I've got to ask the question, is there value?
Well, so that's the cruel irony of the leader's lament. Yes. So, you know, we can look at it from two angles. You know, if we want to be scientific and look at the research, like the excellent recent research from the LinkedIn B2B Institute, which was an IPA collaboration, or if we go back a few years to Google's 2013 research with the CEB, which is now part of Gartner, or look at the B2B work of Byron Sharp and the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, it all shows you need distinction and emotion, and you need to build a brand through fame and ownable assets and not just activate it. And you know, I don't care what your favorite marketing buzzword is, if it's classic marketing and positioning or storytelling or behavioral economics, or if it's data-driven, it's everywhere. It's kind of like, it's fundamental. It is baked into the paradigm of marketing, but the gravity pull is still very strong. Now, if you want to take another way to look at it and just intuitively say, what becomes the stuff marketing professionals talk about and consider best practice? Then you get to things like IBM's Smarter Planet, right? Like mythical campaign, or some of the stuff Microsoft or GE do. And again, there's a lot of distinction in those things. And you look at them and you see clear stories and interesting ideas and very high levels of craft. And you can see those things fighting, really fighting to make things interesting. And yes, while, you know, by the time you went all the way through their entire funnel and their entire content ecosystem, then all the boxes are ticked. But at the top level, up in front, there are strong, inspiring stories, which almost like, you know, the McCann motto of truth well told. And it's important to flag, by the way, before I'm visited by the ghost of Byron Sharp present, that quite often it's not about a sustainable point of difference in the classic sense of the word, but about owning something that could on many levels be generic, but committing to it in an interesting and distinctive way. I mean, it's not like only GE's engineers have imagination, but if you go for something like imagination at work and your brand behaviors deliver it with commitment and craft, then it can work. And yes, it's harder to drive through, but once you achieve the escape velocity from the black hole of being generic, the awards are greater too. And you know, it's often as expensive to put out a bland, badly crafted idea to the market, especially when the bigger costs are often in media or in production, or time spent in meeting approving it, which no one ever takes into account for some reason.
So let's talk about that escape velocity then. How can leaders break out of death by tick box?
So I think, you know, it's almost like a three-step plan as far as I'm concerned. So I think acknowledging the dynamic is the first step to solving it. And good marketing directors often have to educate their stakeholders in that way. And when the penny drops, people can slowly let go of the laundry list. So, you know, you contrast the laundry list with inspiring work and you give your stakeholders an appetite. Then the second step you need is to find the right partners. And that's both internally and externally. People that get it and are committed to doing something that people notice. People who aren't just happy with simply making everyone nod and just getting paid and surviving another pointless exercise of branding. You get those partners internally and externally. And then the final step is you walk away with that closely knit team of partners and you avoid the big committees as much as you can. And instead, you come back to the big committee And B2B always has a very large stakeholder group. And you go back to the committee with a tight argument for the brain side of things, but also concepts that really excite them and speak to the heart and to their instincts. And yes, you know, I mean, people say, oh, but it's going to be so political. Yes, you know, it's going to be political. So if it's going to be political, you have to have a bold political campaign.
So can you offer an example then of a business that's done this, a business that's broken out?
So my favorite example, which is quite close to home, is a brand I worked with for many years, and that's Deloitte. So they went through a deep repositioning and brand identity evolution with the partners where I used to be head of strategy around 2009. And I joined that process later, but learned a lot from it nevertheless. So where they were, you know, they were like a top 10 and they wanted to become a top 3 in their sector. And, you know, now it's a given that they're one of the top 3. Mm. But most of that category at the time was kind of like corporate blue and boring and cliched. And the very brave question they asked is, can we become a category 1 in order to really push ourselves towards the top of that leadership set? And that led to a strong brand idea and a focused set of tools that they then used for almost a decade with a very high level of commitment. You know, they kept finding new and interesting ways to deliver it again and again, never tiring, never saying, oh, let's start the whole strategic process again, just finding new ways to make it great again with uncompromising creativity and craft. And yes, throughout that decade, the competition also started getting better, but they just kept investing in it. And that had that relentlessness about it. So, you know, commitment just counts for so much in that kind of situation. And by the way, I think it owes a lot to their global brand director, Brian Resnick, who's, you know, you should definitely get on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. What advice then would you give more generally to B2B marketers with a branding remit?
Well, I think I think that for quite a lot of people out there, they kind of feel, you know, they're tired of kind of like constantly fighting stakeholders. I think what they need to understand is that you know, they probably know that nowadays B2B branding can be as exciting as B2C branding. And I think there's a lot of value in just realizing it's okay. That's the structure dynamic. There's this generic gravitational pull. And my role is to help my organization break away from it. So I'm going to acknowledge it head on. But then I'm going to explain very clearly to those people that we got to be more distinctive and we got to have commitment, even if we are just talking about things that are, you know, are part of the category and we're one of those many sectors where clear differentiation doesn't work, we can still find the way to do things distinctively.
Uwe Baruchin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the hidden casualties of the COVID-19 crisis was direct marketing. All of a sudden, our target audience weren't coming into offices anymore, and so there was no way of reaching them via this channel. So is this the end of a channel with an illustrious B2B history? I'm joined now by Lisa Daniels, the head of marketing of B2B Enterprise, to discuss. Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, before we get on to DM, you should tell us a bit about BT Enterprise.
Yeah, sure. So BT Enterprise is just one organisation within the BT group, comprises both BT and EE brands for enterprise. So that's the B2B part of BT for UK and Ireland. We serve over 1 million SMEs, over half of the FTSE 350, and our customers range from major corporate household names, government departments, public service organisations, right the way through to smaller businesses and startups. So we cover the communications and IT services market, everything from voice, mobility, cloud, networking, and IoT and so on.
So what does BT Enterprise traditionally use direct marketing for?
So we do lots of direct marketing, you know, primarily email, SMS, telemarketing, and actually, you know, less and less direct mail over the years, as have many organisations. Primarily, we've shifted to electronic forms of communication in our service estate. It's the customer preference. It's obviously good for from a sustainability an environmental commitment too. So we have always had a full mix of direct marketing because obviously the multi-channel approach is remains, you know, the right one. And I think it's always been the conundrum of how much communication is too much. And it's really important to map out all of your different communications for any given task or platform. We do an awful lot of base communication, as you'd imagine, to making sure that we're maintaining day-to-day trading. But we also, you know, support our big campaigns when we want to elevate our above the line promotions. And we also have a huge regulatory mandatory element to what we do as well, which we support services with.
So there's lots of direct marketing that you mentioned there. So that kind of begs the question, when the COVID crisis came along, did direct marketing stop for BT Enterprise? And if so, what did you do instead?
We didn't stop our direct marketing per se. We did a full review of our communications. And, you know, from a marketing communication perspective, we made sure that no campaigns continued, particularly to the sectors who were under the most scrutiny, likely to have been furloughed, such as hairdressers and hospitality. We pivoted the communication to be more of a supporting message about how BT can help, whether that be with payment terms and helping them with the current sort of contracts that they might have with us, but also how they could help use technology to diversify their business models, how we could help them get their team set up working securely from home. So it was a much more, you know, helpful position based on the current times. But clearly, you know, the world didn't actually stop. It stopped in some places and it changed for everything else. So we just had to review everything, change the content, the tone, and make sure that clearly nothing was going out that didn't feel like it fit with the right, you know, the right times.
So you you paint a picture of a world in which direct marketing is constantly changing. So if I were to ask you to get your crystal ball out, can you take us to the future of direct marketing in B2B? What does it look like?
Sure. So I think the first question of, is there a future for direct marketing? I wholeheartedly think there is. I think it has been a great sort of channel for evolving constantly anyway. I hope that as a result of the pandemic and the sort of pause button that we've all probably had to hit, that we can actually take stock of what we're measuring, how we're measuring it, what value it's driving, and where it's not driving. I think where it's not driving value. I think that it's such an important element of any account-based marketing strategy. You know, it is the way that you create a one-to-one communication with a customer if sales aren't present. You know, and you know that engagement is known to drive both sales, value, NPS, and also consideration, you know, so it works on a brand level as well as a trading level. I think that what this gives us the opportunity to do, though, is to come out of this with a refreshed view of some of our programs, particularly those that are trigger based, automated, maybe set in stone a few months or years ago. And I think it's a great opportunity to actually take a look at that, take stock and evolve that to the new world. But, you know, as with any direct marketing strategy, it should be based on the behaviors, the preferences, you know, the message you need to land. So, you know, the marketing mix has never been more relevant. You know, I think that any organizations who haven't made that shift to more digital communications, which are clearly easier to measure, often more efficient, you know, I think that now is a great time to consider doing that, and they probably are and are learning a lot as a result of that. But I do think that direct mail, you know, still does have its place. I think at one point there was a a kind of feeling that actually direct mail was being ignored because everything felt like it wasn't relevant. And actually, you don't get that much through your doors anymore. I barely get posts really delivered to me through work, whether it doesn't reach me or whether it's not being sent. But I think that if you've got something meaningful and tangible that you want to present to a customer that needs a bit more depth and a bit more grit than maybe an email or an SMS or any other form of communication would, I think it absolutely has its place. So I think that there will be a sort of revival, but it will be quite spared, I think, for the right experiences, for the right customer in the right context.
So what one bit of advice would you give to B2B marketers who are making their channel mix decisions right now?
I would say to go back and reanalyze everything that you can't currently put your finger on where it fits in your comm strategy or what benefits it delivers for your customers or for the business. I think everyone has those activities within their marketing mix that you often don't get the chance to look at. But, you know, I think whilst budgets and resources for B2B marketing is ever under scrutiny, you know, now is the time to make sure that you stop anything that either isn't driving value or it's not building towards an, you know, an overarching strategy that you're trying to land, you know, with your customers, because sometimes more communication can be worse than less, actually. So I think, you know, the entire landscape's changed. So customers are interacting and buying differently all the time. That's happened anyway. This has just amplified that scenario. And I think, you know, the impact of COVID, you know, things like sales strategies are under question. You know, how do we move to a more digital world? So if you don't have a really big digital content-led approach, I think now is the time to reanalyze whether that's the right thing for you.
So time to take stock then. Lisa Daniels, Head of Marketing at BT Enterprise, thank you very much. Next up, Rachel Evans shares a key lesson that she's taken on the journey to being a co-founder of Stack for Business. Rachel, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Thank you, Dave. Thank you for inviting me.
So what on earth is Stack for Business then?
Well, there is actually a story behind the name, so hopefully I'll be able to do it justice. So everything we do as a consultancy is about stacking the odds in favour of growth, hence why we're called Stack for Business. So it took us no less than one whole afternoon to come up with that gem. So but it really does reflect kind of what our focus is as a business. And it's we wanted to focus on what Alex and I both enjoy and what our experience lends itself well to. And that's really about unlocking new profitable revenue opportunities. So whether that be working with our clients who are looking to sell new services into new audiences or new markets or a combination of all of those things. And that's what we wanted to focus on. So our backgrounds are varied. So I've had in-house and agency, and Alex has got kind of the same combination of experience as well. And the lessons that we learned from our time in agency and in-house is really to focus on what you're good at. So neither of us really believe in full service agencies or jack of all trade marketers. And what we believed we were really good at was identifying how marketing can connect better with commercial outcomes. And for us, that's about where are there the biggest opportunities for revenue growth in the business and how can we help you unlock those? And we do a number of things in order to do that. But I sense you have another question brewing, Dave.
Well, it was kind of off the back of what you were talking about there, because I always kind of ask people at this point, you know, what makes a brilliant business marketer? And I'm therefore guessing that you're going to say, oh, it's somebody who's focused on growth and commercial success. Is that, is that what you're going to say?
No. No, actually. I think in terms of what makes a great marketer is less clear cut than that. So for us, it's about, we really enjoy the commercial challenge of what we do. And I've built my career in numerous roles about not necessarily trying to be the best marketer in the room, but trying to be the most commercial person in the room. So I know lots of people who are amazing at marketing tactics and digital marketing and social media and so forth. But what I really wanted to build my career on was the commercial aspect. And in most of the roles to date, I often found myself in kind of a bridging role between marketing and the business, a kind of a translator. So whereas I was really interested in understanding the business and how it made money, how the partners I worked for, or how the sales team I worked for were incentivized, you know, where were there really profitable opportunities for growth rather than where were we just going to see revenue anyway? And I was really interested in that challenge. So how can we use marketing to unlock those opportunities better? And how can we get more clarity on what those opportunities are in the first place? So I think my advice is not necessarily to people to be commercial, although I would always say that as a marketer, if you are commercial, it makes your job easier. But I think being all things to all people isn't a viable career strategy. So having a focus, so really understanding what is it that you want to build your name for? What is it that you enjoy? What is it that you're good at? And build your reputation around that and become great at that, rather than trying to do everything, keep up with everything, you know, in that sense. And also the other things I think that make a really good marketer are probably more mindset and soft skill focused. So I really believe in like being ambitious and having bold ambition. And that's one of the key values of that Alex and I have as a business. And that's about focusing on the biggest commercial challenges and understanding how marketing can unlock those opportunities. We're not very big on kind of standard playbooks, standard approaches to things, looking to your competitors for your inspiration or to benchmark your performance. So for us, it's about always being ambitious, and I would definitely encourage people to kind of have that mindset. And then I think probably the third thing, although I could go on, the numbers is kind of be a master of persuasion. So that always puts you in a good position, regardless of what career you're in. But I think especially in marketing, especially when, you know, we're trying to get a seat at the table and we're trying to prove our value from a business perspective, I think all the great marketers I know who have achieved that have been really able to effectively challenge. So, you know, that's really being able to listen, ask the right questions and challenge back in a really effective way. So I think being a master of persuasion will get you far.
So and I'm interested in all four of those qualities that you mentioned there, Rachel, but it seems to start with self-awareness. And I wonder for people listening to this who are interested in, I guess, building up their levels of self-awareness, do you have advice for them on how to go about it?
I think self-awareness comes with time. So it's difficult to rush that. But I think in the meantime, to kind of help accelerate that, I would definitely encourage people to kind of experiment with new roles, to really kind of stretch themselves in a new way, take on new projects in their existing roles, or consider their next career move to be slightly different from the position they're in at the moment. And then really take time to reflect on each and every role or each and every project, you know, in terms of your own assessment, but also seek feedback about, you know, where your strengths were, where there was a strength and where that marries with a role or a skill you enjoyed using or a project you enjoyed executing. That's often a good place to start to say, okay, well, if I want to do more of that, if I want to do more of this kind of stuff that I'm good at, other people think I'm good at, and also that I enjoy, that gives you more of an understanding of how you can develop your career. And actually, as you move forward, what sort of marketer do you want to be? What kind of name do you want to make for yourself? What do you want to build your reputation on? But, you know, for me, that came with experimenting with a number of roles. I didn't start my career as a marketer. I started my career in more commercial roles, in sales, in account management, and kind of ended up in a marketing role for an organization that was looking to commercialize their content. So it's kind of running a publishing business and making money to invest then in that content to help them sell new consultancy propositions.
Not just in different roles, but also in different companies.
In different companies. So I've worked in technology businesses, I've worked in consultancies, law firms, accounting firms, and a number of, things I've taken from those roles that I've enjoyed has always been, as I said, that real focus on understanding the business. How does it make money? How can we make more money? And what can marketing do to do that? But that took time for me to realize. So I think, when you're younger, you're kind of chasing the next role. Whereas if you can take time to reflect and then stretch yourself with new roles, new projects in new ways, that self-awareness does come. And for me, I didn't leave university and said, one day I'm going to set up a consultancy called Stack with my friend and colleague, Alex. I didn't have any clear set ambition from the start that I was going to do that. But as a consequence of really better understanding myself as a marketer, what I enjoyed doing, what I was good at, and finding somebody else who shared that same vision and complementary skill sets, created an opportunity for Alex and I to do something together. But I definitely wouldn't have had the self-awareness to do that 10 years before or 5 years before.
It's great speaking with you. Rachel Evans, co-founder of Stack for Business. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dave.
There's some great business marketing out there, and I'm joined now by Rebecca Highfield, who is marketing manager at Action Rocket, to look at some of it. Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. It's great to be speaking with you today. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for coming along. So first of all, tell us a bit about Action Rocket.
So I head up the marketing for Action Rocket. We're a creative team of passionate marketers, designers and coders who create award-winning marketing campaigns. We focus and specialise in design, technology coding and planning for the email channel. And we work with some amazing brands, both B2B and B2C.
Well, let's not talk about the B2C stuff. Let's focus on the B2B stuff here. And that means, I think, in your job, you must have come across lots and lots of great business marketing. So what's caught your eye?
So email's rapidly becoming the preferred channel for B2B marketers because it allows for a direct conversational style of communication. So it's really important for them to stand out in the inbox, and there's so many ways of doing so. One of the great examples that I found was Asana. They're a great example of how to use engagement in email successfully. They're an online project management tool, which we use at Action Rocket. They engage their subscribers by sending three types of emails: marketing, transactional, and blog related. The marketing emails keep us updated on the actual product itself, so presenting new features and demonstrating how easy their tool is to use. We're always on the lookout for ways of improving our team efficiency. So they're always one step ahead at showing us what new features are available and upgrades to our subscription. The transactional emails keep us in touch with our live projects. So these are helpful for team collaboration. So if somebody writes a comment within a project, then everybody in that project will be notified. So you're able to turn these emails off if you don't want them, but actually it's a quite nice way of the brand interacting with you as a user, making sure that you've seen the notifications and things for your projects which are live with clients. And then their blog emails, they're just a helpful way of sending industry content. It's quite nice to receive this straight into my inbox, so whenever they've written a new blog or something, I don't need to go onto their website and see what's new. I'm actually getting it direct from the mouth, from the brand, which is really nice.
So they
send content at the right time to the right people. So there's nothing worse than receiving an email from a brand who's got the customer journey completely wrong. But Asana do it really well, where they're messaging is never too salesy, but equally you're reminded about new features and updates without being forced to think that you have to quickly upgrade your subscription or something.
Because it's very interesting that you pick this example, because if I had a pound for every time a business sent me a piece of email marketing telling me about their capabilities and following up on a very, very regular basis, I'd be a very, very rich person right now. So is it the timeliness, or is it the the actual content, or what is it that really impresses you about this?
So they've created a really nice seamless customer journey. I think it's nice that they've categorized and segmented their emails, so I know which type of emails I'm receiving. And it's all three of the versions are very different. So I know that when it's blog related, the content is specifically about that. I don't need to scroll down the email and try and find out what I'm looking for. I think the actual interface itself, we enjoy using it because it's such a great user experience. And it's just nice that they've translated this into their email journey as well. They're also really nicely designed. So they frequently use icons, which works really well for like list or to-do formats. And with this kind of project management tool, that's quite frequent. They also have a really, they always use a clear call to action, which is super important for any brand and any email. So it's clear that they've thought about the action that they want the subscriber to take. So it's always pushing us towards that button at the bottom of the email, whether it's towards a blog or a website page or just towards the tool itself.
And this is always a difficult question because you're in a different business to the one that you've chosen. But what have you learned from their approach that you'll apply to your future work?
It's important for brands to remember that the customer service as a whole. So a lot of things fall within this: branding, design, and tone of voice. So ensuring that this is replicated across all mediums is really important. We recently launched our website, so it was important for us to encompass all of these factors. It's really important to nail your brand identity because then it's easy for your customers to remember who you are. So like Asana, where they have a great user experience on their website, they've replicated that through their email and within their social channels and their blog. So just having that whole customer experience, I would then translate that as a brand that I recognize quite easily.
Rebecca Highfield at Action Rocket, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Uwe Baruchin, Lisa Daniels, Rachel Evans and Rebecca Highfield. And thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian and Josh Bench. Thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by business marketers for business marketers. Check out the webinars, podcasts, events, mentoring, blogs, newsletters, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.